Test, test. This is Dave Crippen of the SOB Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. And this is May 15th, 1986. And today we're in beautiful Orinda, California, just east of Oakland in the lovely hill country. And we're speaking with Mr. Rhys, that's R-H-Y-S, D. Miller, a longtime automotive designer and who has had experience with several automotive companies in Michigan and elsewhere. And we've asked Mr. Miller to tell us about his career in automotive design, how he got started, and what work experiences he had, and his associates along the way, and to give us a look at the early days of automotive design, as well as in more recent years. So we let him tell his story in his own way.
Well, as far back as I can remember, I've been interested in automobiles, and I think that it probably stemmed from my dad, who started out as a machinist, and then became a race driver, and then ultimately a automobile dealer. And
where was that?
This was in Montana. He's started racing cars across country. This is the days when they'd take a Model T and strip the fenders off, or a Hudson Super 6, and take the fenders off and put a couple of bucket seats on it and take off across the country. Mm-hmm. And he was always an automobile enthusiast, and I guess that's where I got my interest. He was always talking cars, and I started drawing cars when I was just a little kid. And by the time I was 5 or 6, I could name all the cars that passed our house. And my dad used to show me off to friends that way,
right.
Ask me to sit there and name all the cars that went by, which I did.
How big of a town was Lewiston in those days?
Well, Lewiston, I don't know. That's where I was born. Then we moved around in Montana a little bit, uh-huh. And then came out to Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And Lewiston, I think in 1914, when I was born there, mm-hmm. Probably wasn't over maybe 10,000 people, mm-hmm. if that much. And later on, as I say, my dad became an automobile dealer, and he had different automobile agencies in the 20s. I can remember he had one called Jewett.
Oh, yeah.
Jewett and Page together. They were
J-E-W-E-T-T,
I believe it was.
Page.
P-A-I-G-E.
Right.
Yeah.
And is that in Portland?
That was in Albany, Oregon.
Albany.
In Albany. And prior to this, in 1920, when he was in Montana, he bought a Packard Twin Six. And this was just after World War I. And he didn't like the looks of it, so he redesigned it. And he had a special top built for it, and special fenders that had fender wells and had side mounts, and then he also had two tires on the back with a big patent leather hat box, mm-hmm. in the center of the tires, and also on the sides of the cars there was patent leather compartments that you could open up and store things.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful automobile. It had special paint, of course, and special leather interior and all. And then in 1925, when he had the Jewett Page Agency, he took a Page 666. That was a model designation, I think. And
was that for the motor, or was it just simply a?
I don't know. I don't know what the designation really meant. But it had a very racy looking body, even to begin with. I believe the instead of the rear of the rear of the body tapering in at the bottom,
yeah.
It went out like a more of a streamline, like a not a boat tail, but a line that went aft rather than forward at the bottom. And so he designed special, and had made up special fenders for it. They had long sweeping clamshell fenders in the front and the rear. And again, wire wheels and fender wells. And beautiful blue paint job and a very light khaki or beige canvas top on it. It was a Phaeton.
Where do you get this body work done?
There was a body company in a little shop, I guess, in Portland that was about maybe 75 miles from Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the people there, and he would go in there and work with them on it. He was a good sheet metal man and quite a mechanic. And
incredible.
So they put this car together. It was a real show car.
You remember, of course, driving in.
Oh, yes, yes. And everybody in town, it was the best looking car in all of Albany, Oregon. And everybody used to ogle it. Anyway, he was always a buyer and a seller, so he had it for maybe a year or so, and then he traded it for an airplane.
An airplane.
And
what year was this?
This, I guess, it was about 1925. Uh-huh. Must have been 25. I was probably about 11 years old.
Aviation was
10 or 11.
Booming at that time.
Yeah, well, it was just getting started. I think at about that time they had the first airmail flights. I remember the Army had the first airmail delivery.
Colonel Lindbergh was doing it.
And Lindbergh came along in 1927. Yeah, I remember that because
he was flying airmail before that, though.
That's right. Yes, he was flying airmail. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And barnstorming pilots used to come into Albany, Oregon occasionally with their biplanes. So they were flying Jennies from war surplus airplanes, I guess.
Weather was good, so flying the plane.
Yeah, and so I remember this one that came to town, and he was there was a little patch of land outside town where he could land, and he was taking people up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was doing a few stunts over town, and then we had a river that ran through the town, the Willamette River. I remember watching the plane, and he went down. I could see him go down toward the river, and he was going to fly under the bridge. And so he had done this a couple of times before. And anyway, I saw him go down to go under the bridge, and I didn't see him come up again. So another kid and I there watched me, ran down to the river, and sure enough, there he was, nose first into a sand bank in the sandbar in the river. And anyway, there was a lot of interest in airplanes around that time, as I said. And so somebody in town had an airplane. My dad was very interested in it, so he traded this page for the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeded to take flying lessons, and then he got tired of that and sold that off. But anyway, he was quite a guy,
what a great way to grow up.
So I had the automobile influence for a long time. And then we moved from Albany, Oregon to Los Angeles in 1928, and then my dad became a Willis Knight dealer,
mm-hmm.
and they had the Willis Knight and Whippet agency. And
he was a good salesman. He was able to move from one place to another.
And, yes, yes, he was quite a salesman. And anyway, his agency was only about two blocks away from the Auburn Chord agency in L.A. It was the it was on Western Avenue, and I remember when the L-29 Chord first made its first appearance at that showroom, and my dad and I rushed down there to see it, and everybody was very, very excited about that car, which was a great looking car, a great design, and so we actually had a ride in it and all that. And my dad couldn't be too enthusiastic about it because, you know, after all, he was a Willis Knight dealer. And he said, well, there's a few things, very nice car, a few things wrong with it. He said, that front drive is kind of shaky. He says, when you shift gears, the front wheels chatter on you. He said, I don't like that. And that was one of the drawbacks of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, then all this time, I, of course, was drawing automobiles and all through high school, I drew cars.
Where'd you go to high school there?
Emanuel Arts High School in Los Angeles.
Emanuel?
No, Manual.
Manual Arts.
Manual Arts.
Was that that wasn't on Weston?
No, it was on Vermont.
Vermont
Street, and it was very close to the USC campus, present campus, USC, and the Coliseum, the stadium that was built for the. For the 1932 Olympics,
uh-huh.
And so Manual Arts was just maybe a mile from there. That's the location.
Where did you live?
And we lived very close to the school. I don't remember the
name
of the street or anything. But I know I had an old Overland car that was my high school car.
Did you really?
And Overland Bluebird, I guess it was.
Was that part of the Willis Group?
I don't remember. I think it was a used car that my dad had taken in on a trade or something, and so he gave it to me. And I, at that time, kids were painting their cars up with a lot of slogans and things painted all over them.
Called graffiti today.
Graffiti, right. And it didn't have a top on it. And anyway, it was kind of a fun car, and I, of course, had a lot of things painted on it, but My prize statement I liked that I put on wrote on the back of it was Mercedes bends but this doesn't.
That's great.
And and the Mercedes at that time of course was a very exotic car, and very few people really knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Not like today where so well known.
By conversation, please.
Right, but we lived in Hollywood, and almost across the street from the Warner Brothers motion picture studio, and it was on Bronson, I believe, our apartment house was. And then just up around the corner from Warner Brothers, and on Sunset Boulevard, and down about three or four blocks was the Mercedes-Benz showroom.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't very large or very impressive, but they usually had two or three Mercedes in there.
Right.
And I was probably about 15 or something like that, and I'd go down there and ogle them from the outside and occasionally get up enough nerve to go inside and take a better look.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the famous SS series, SSKs and all, which are just priceless today. They were supercharged SSKs. And as I say, we lived on this Bronson Street, and occasionally one of them would come down the street. The salesman would be demonstrating one to a client,
right,
to a customer. and it would come roaring down Bronson, and he would hit the throttle, and the supercharger would cut in, and you could just kind of feel the ground shake. It was that type of car, and so that was quite thrilling to me.
It must have been. Did you ever get up enough nerve to ask the salesman to give you a ride?
No, I never get that far. And they were selling for about $15,000 in there with
Of course, in those days, I suppose people had those stock market days that people
bought. Yeah, there's 28, 29. There was money, of course, in Hollywood. The movie people had money, and that was the reason for the showroom right there in Hollywood, because they bought quite a few of them.
Have you ever seen any Warner Brothers stars in the neighborhood?
No, I'd see big limousines pull in there occasionally, but our school was right next door too to the studio, and that was the junior high school that I went to.
What was the name of that?
LeConte Junior High.
How do you spell
it? L E capital C O N T E. And I sold papers for a while. We lived there on Sunset Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
And
Los Angeles Times, was it?
Okay. Yeah, I think it was the Times. There was and the Express. I think it was the Times and
the Express
Evening Express or something Express.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I had two or three papers there, and I sold them on corner of Gardner Junction and Sunset Boulevard, and I remember. Seeing Gary Cooper drive past in his Duesenberg Phaeton.
Yeah, I've seen photos of that.
Yeah. And one time he stopped and bought a couple of papers from me, which
marvelous.
Was quite a thrill.
Tanned, good, tall, good looking.
Yeah, thing. Right.
Slow spoken.
Yeah, I was very impressed. Very, And that was my junior high school days, and then senior high school, we moved to into Los Angeles, and I went to Manual Arts. And I took mechanical drawing and architectural drawing. I thought that might help me in my automobile drawing, which it did. It gave me an appreciation of line and a certain discipline. And so by that time, I was making pretty good line drawings, side views of cars, my own designs, and I heard about Murphy Body and a company in Pasadena, and so occasionally I would skip school and drive the old car over to
the Overland.
Well, by this time, I think I had a Dodge. Four-cylinder Dodge touring car, no top, of course. And
no top.
I just couldn't afford it.
Okay, all right.
The tops were out, and I couldn't afford new tops.
Fine,
this was into the Depression, and and my dad's business had gone down the drain, and it was tough going. Anyway, I would skip school occasionally, and drive over to Pasadena and hang around Murphy Body Company, and they had a little window in the front of the building, like a little show window or showcase.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't very big; it was just a small thing, but. Anyway, there'd usually be a drawing or rendering of it.
This here?
Yeah. That's the building. But it seems to me that they would display a drawing or two in one of these windows along here, on either side of the entrance.
What street was that on again? Does it say there?
It probably does in the article here someplace. It doesn't say here now. Yeah, he was a a Hudson Essex dealer or distributor, I guess.
Initially, yeah.
And I see the sign Essex on this on the building right here.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was his main income while he made
I guess so. That's how he started in the automobile business, was being a dealer or a distributor for Hudson Essex.
How'd you find out about the Murphy?
I don't know. Probably from my dad.
He probably
mentioned it, sure. And told me about this place.
Yeah.
And as I say, I'd see these renderings, the first I'd ever seen of anybody else drawing a car, mm-hmm. aside from myself.
Right.
Because nobody in school drew cars, and I would show these occasionally to some friends. I said, they'd ask me, what are you doing that for?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd tell him, well, someday I'm going to be a designer.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what that meant. I mean, they didn't even think about people designing cars. Or so there wasn't really that much interest in it. But one day I got up by nerve enough to go inside the shop.
Uh-huh.
And I met Frank Hershey. And he doesn't remember this. I've talked about this years later, and he's, I don't remember that. And I said, well, that happened. I said, I came.
How old were you at the time? About 17?
This is about 16, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was in there, and I got to talk to him, and he saw I was interested in cars, and so he took me over and showed me a Duesenberg that had just been finished.
Ah.
And I was sitting there in a beautiful convertible sedan.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened the door, and I got in and sat down behind the wheel. And I can remember being very impressed with the with the angle of the windshield, because it was probably about a 45-degree slope on the windshield, which was quite extreme in those days, because windshields were vertical or just slightly canted back, maybe mm-hmm. 5 degrees or something.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with this because I could look out of the windshield and look up and look at right at the sky, because mm-hmm. it practically came back over your head. It felt like that anyway.
Yeah.
So, but that was the only time that I was in the plant, but I would get all enthused, then go back, of course, and draw a lot more cars.
Mm-hmm.
Inspired, I guess, is a word for it.
Do you remember what the setup was there at Murphy? You probably weren't as observant as you are in later years, but they had a Hershey. Was Hershey the
he was
design manager?
He was one of the designers.
One
there was
the
yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think it was Frank Hershey and Phil Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And in this article in
the Automobile Quarterly
gives a couple of other names there too. I think Everett Miller was one, and someone else. But I was never in the design room itself.
Oh, you never got into that?
No, just in the shop.
This must have been a fascinating introduction for you as an impressionable youngster.
It was. It was very, because I was just completely awed by it.
Yes.
Completely awed.
You think that cemented your desire to be an automotive designer?
I think so, yes. It gave me some direction. I knew that people were doing this.
Yes.
That they weren't just drawing cards for fun like I was, that somebody was making a living at it.
Right.
And evidently enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
And on such fine cars, too, Duesenberg and Cord and Packards and
Lincolns,
yes. And all that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Even during the Depression, they were at least marginally successful, Murphy.
Yes, yes. They lasted, I think, up until about 1932.
Mm-hmm.
And it's it's funny, later on I in Detroit I met a son, became a very good friend of the son of one of the men who worked in the Murphy shop. I didn't know at the time, but...
Who's that?
Walter Wengren. W-E-N-G-R-E-N. And Walt died about 15 years ago, I guess. But we were the same age, but...
You were telling him about your near miss at the plant, that you had got a good glimpse at how a custom body shop worked.
Right. His dad was a woodworker.
Oh yes.
And built the hardwood framing for the
actual framing. Yeah.
Yeah, for the custom body. Yeah. So anyway, I. Let's say drawing cars all through school. After high school, then I worked a year or so at Safeway stores and tried to save a little money to go to Detroit and take some samples, see if I get a job.
Sure.
And I was going to make a point there. I forgot what it is now. But
you figured at this point that if you really wanted to succeed in this industry, you had to go to Detroit.
Yes, that seemed to be the only avenue to proceed.
Was your father still alive at this time?
Yes, hi.
Was he supportive of this?
Yes. He liked the idea. And
he said you really got to go there.
Right.
In those days, there were no design center like there are in California.
No, there was nothing that I didn't take any art classes, any art training or anything. I had mechanical drawing and architecture drawing.
Was the Art Center school going in Los Angeles at that time?
Yes, it was. I believe it was. I don't know whether it was the same name, Art Center or not.
John Foster talks about it as being a series of starting out in a series of motor homes. Sort of a court motorhome, not motorhomes, what would we call
bungalows?
Bungalows. It would be motor courts, rather.
Oh yeah.
Motor courts, and they just sort of they used all of them. Apparently, the gentleman who started it bought these up. These were just classrooms, and that's how they started out in Los Angeles.
It seemed to me they had a different name though. It wasn't Art Center. Maybe Los Angeles School of Art or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I think it was near Westlake Park.
Was it?
And if it's the same one, because it's the only one that I know about anyway, in the early 30s. But I went there one time, and they had a course in commercial art.
Mm-hmm.
They had no automotive work or anything like that.
No.
But I had made a side drawing of a Piercero chassis.
Oh, really?
And I thought it was a pretty good-looking car, but I wanted it colored, and I didn't know how to render it.
Uh-huh.
So I went to this art school and asked them if there was somebody there that could color this for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot who I talked to now. He said, "Well, we have a student here. I think can do it." And so I said, "Well, fine." And so I met this young fella, and he said, "Yes." He said, "I'll try it." And he said, "What color do you want?" And I said, "Well, green with a tan top." It was a convertible, two-door convertible. And so he took the drawing and made the rendering, and I went back to get it a few days later, and it looked very good.
Mm.
It wasn't as good as the Murphy renderings by a long way, but at least it had some color on it, and it was quite good looking to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him $5 for doing it, and he thought that was a lot of money, and it was a lot of money because I was working after school That it, well, this was before Safeway. In a restaurant, washing dishes, and for $5 a week.
Wow.
After school, so anyway, that $5 was my week's wages. But anyway, that was my first colored rendering.
And you kept that in your portfolio.
Well, no, I never used it in my portfolio because somebody else did the rendering. But I when I went to Detroit with samples, none of them were colored.
Oh, I see.
They were all line drawings.
Okay.
But
gave you an idea of what could be done.
Right. So, say after high school, I worked for a year and saved some money, and then another fellow and I took a camping trip. He had a Model A Ford, and we took a trip across. Started from L.A. and went up into. Yeah, we went.
What was your friend's name? Remember
that I went with?
Your camping friend.
Yeah, his name was Dave Woods.
What's happened to him?
I don't know.
No.
So he was from Canada.
Oh, he was.
So he on this trip, we were going to Chicago, and this was the 1933, the year of the World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to see the fair, and then he was going. We split up there, and he was going on home to into Canada, Manitoba, I believe it is from.
Well.
So we went up through. Idaho and
Glacier
National Park and Montana and then over to Chicago. And I saw the World's Fair, which was very impressive, and I saw the two cars impressed me very much. One was the in the General Motors display, it was the Cadillac 16, and it was a fastback, first fastback I'd ever seen.
Right.
And it had had the pontoon fenders, which were very new, and then there was the Piercero. It was either the silver or the golden arrow, I forget which now, but that was a very streamlined car done by Phil Wright, formerly of Pasadena, of Murphy Body.
Mm. Did you see the Ford exhibit?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
In view of your later associations, did you see the Charta experimental rear engine car in the 40s?
Yes. I'm glad you reminded me of that. Right. Because later on, that I'll tell you about John Charta.
Right.
I worked for John.
Right.
And yes, that car, along with the Cadillac and the Piercero, was quite a experience for me.
Very exciting.
The high points of the World's Fair.
Right. Exactly.
So
Model A. Or was that?
That was Dave's car.
That was Dave Woods.
Yeah. And so we split up there, and then he went on to Canada, and so I took a bus and went down to Detroit, and I had brought with me. Three or four line drawings of cars.
You stopped at my hometown, probably, Battle Creek.
We went through Battle Creek.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, right.
I was a kid playing around there.
In Battle Creek, is that right? Is that about that time, huh?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, and...
Detroit must have been quite a surprise.
Well, it was much bigger than I thought. When I was a kid, my dad talked about Detroit and everything. I envisioned it as a town about the size of Albany, Oregon. So when I got there and saw what a big city it was, it was rather intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I went to General Motors. I knew that they had a design department, mm-hmm. and I took my drawings to them for an interview, and I was interviewed by Howard O'Leary.
Oh yes, famous Howard O'Leary.
Yes, and so to my surprise, he didn't throw me out or anything. He was very nice.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, I think you have some talent, which made me feel very good.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we don't have an opening right now, but he said, we might, as time goes on here. And he said, would you be interested in moving from California to Detroit if mm-hmm. we did have an opening?
Yeah.
I said, I certainly would. That was the object of my trip.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, well, if we do, I gave him my name and address, of course, and,
uh-huh.
and we'll be in touch with you
mm-hmm.
if something turns up.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Los Angeles then, and I...
Oh, you did?
Yes, I... well, this was just a trip.
Just, I see. Okay.
I hadn't planned on staying.
Oh, okay.
And...
Did you try any of the other automobile companies while you were there?
No, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
GM was the only one that I knew of that had a design department.
Yeah, you may well be
right. I'm sure that Ford did, and I found out later that Briggs did some of the design and so on. But to me, I that at that time, that was the only thing that I knew.
Right.
So that's where I headed. And so I going back to Detroit, there were ads run in the paper, the daily papers, of people that could drive cars, new cars, from Detroit to Los Angeles.
Oh,
at that
course.
Time, the dealers would come back and buy these cars and then save the shipping charges.
By having people drive them out.
By having people drive them
right.
out. So that was for me, because I could drive, and I only had $15 left anyway.
Right.
There's no way to get back to L.A. on $15. So I could get free transportation, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured I could get by with $15 would last me for food money till I got home. So we started out on this caravan.
How did it work?
Well, this fellow was a used car dealer, I guess. They advertised him as nearly new cars in L.A.,
right.
So he was a nearly new automobile dealer.
Right.
And it turned out that that I had gone to high school, with one of his sisters, his younger sister.
Yeah. Manual arts?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that I knew her quite well. And
that helped.
Yes.
Yeah.
So... anyway, he got this crew assembled, and it was a motley crew. There was everything from kids like me to married people with
mm-hmm.
children who were driving.
Who needed the transportation?
Yeah.
Right. No pay, I suspect.
No, not a cent. No, you were
How
on
about food.
No food
Slept
money.
Slept in the cars.
Slept in the cars.
Yeah.
Drive as hard as fast as you could, and. If you ran out of food money, you just ran out.
He wasn't very rather hard-hearted. Huh?
Yeah, so he drove the lead car, and I think there were about must have been about 12 cars in the caravan, and they were all Chrysler products, I believe. They were Plymouths and Dodges and DeSotos.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did you drive? Remember?
Well, they would change off the cars occasionally,
right.
And I think I started out with a Plymouth, and ended up I drove more.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think there was a Chrysler too. I think he had a Chrysler that he was driving.
Yeah.
Jerry Lynch was his name.
Oh my God!
Jerry
so
Lynch
sounds like a used car dealer.
Right, and he was. In fact, later on, after I'd come to Detroit and worked there, but Jerry Lynch was in business, opened a used car shop in on Woodward Avenue. And
right.
Matter of fact, I bought a car from him one time.
It wasn't the same one.
Jerry Lynch, same guy.
Same one.
Well,
that's where I heard the name. Yeah.
Yeah. He was quite a dealer in used cars in Detroit for a long time. Jerry Lynch on Woodward Avenue.
Same person. Yeah.
You do you remember that name?
Yes.
Well, that's the guy.
Sure. That's why you had instant recognition.
Yeah. A very tough character. Yeah.
Hard, really.
Hard
to get on with, but fair.
Yeah, fairly fair.
He didn't try to euchre you out of the deal. You got to Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah, right. And we, as I said, I think it was about 12 cars starting out. And someplace shall I go out with this kind of thing here?
This is this is real Americana.
Someplace in Oklahoma, we were on a detour, and there it was dirt roads. And he told us, you know, to keep in line and nose to tail all the way through, and don't get separated, and try not to let other cars in between the caravan and so on.
What was that phrase you used? Know what?
Nose to tail.
Oh, nose to tail. Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
And so we, it was in the middle of summer, really hot, in July, and we were down in Oklahoma someplace on this godforsaken detour.
Dusty.
Clouds of dust is coming up. Yes.
Yeah.
You could hardly see it at all. And
there was no stopping for water or anything like that.
Not very often. So, some of these cars, I believe most of them, we were driving a car and pulling a car, towing a car.
Oh, I see it, tow one. Yeah,
yes.
A real caravan.
Yeah, and so there might have been more than 12 cars in it, but you drive and tow a car. So there were a couple of characters that were always horsing around, they were fellows maybe in their middle 20s or something.
Relieve the boredom.
Yeah, and they would pass. They would take chances. They would pass other people in the caravan generally take chances and would smart mouth everybody. They were just a couple of smart asses. So anyway. As I say, we were on this detour, and clouds of dust blowing up, and you had to have the windows open because there was no air conditioning. All this dust coming in, out in black. Anyway, these guys decided that they were going to pass somebody in the caravan, and they whipped out to pass, and there was a car coming the other way, and all this clouds of dust and everything, they couldn't see a head-on collision.
Oh.
So,
did Lynch ever get out of that?
Well, we didn't for a while, and the police were summoned. They got there somewhere or other, and state troopers, and the whole caravan was impounded then at the next town, until they decided how this would come out, because people were injured in the car that they hit, and these two clowns were not injured. One got a broken nose. I think that was about the extent of it. But the people in the other car were more seriously injured, but nobody was killed.
Was Lynch insured?
God knows. I really don't know. Probably not. Anyway, they pulled us into some kind of a campgrounds, I guess you'd call it.
Right, primitive campgrounds.
Yeah, primitive campgrounds where a bunch of Okies were camping around there. This is really the Dust Bowl days.
Sure.
Anyway,
about 35. About 35.
This was in 33.
Oh, 33.
33, yeah.
Okay.
Year of the World's Fair. So, they put us into this terrible place, and there was a big lake, kind of a big stagnant-looking lake there, and it was hot as hell, so everybody wanted to strip off and get in this water and take a bath, you know, and this was about maybe 3 days out of Detroit, nobody had a bath or a shower, just sleeping in the car.
All that horrible
dust. Yeah. So we stripped down, we jumped in the lake, and we were there quite a while, and finally some man came running down the road, waving, and out of the water, get out of the water. And why? Water moccasins in there. This place is alive with water moccasins. So
some of the most poisonous snakes in the South.
That's right. So we got the hell out of there in a hurry.
Nobody got bit.
And that no. And so that was the end of our swimming. But I think we were there about 3 days. and
before they ironed out the legal issues.
Yeah, and before that, they let us go on. So Jerry finally got the okay to go. So,
that's funny.
And so I was trying to stretch this $15, of course, this food.
Incredible.
But I did manage to get into town one night and go to a movie, and then that was a 10-cent movie. Sure. And those days didn't cost you very much.
Do you remember what town it was? Do you remember what movie it was?
No, I don't. Probably not a very good one. But anyway, that was the first episode. So then we continued on, and I've forgotten how many days it took us to make this trip, but Jerry would try and get us to drive as long as we could each day, because he wanted to get back to L.A., and well, so did everybody else. But everybody was getting pretty tired, exhausted by this time. And we stopped one afternoon, and we'd just gotten into California, I believe, and some of the people were exhausted. They wanted to stay there that night.
You're on 66
and rest.
No, Route 66 no,
day. I believe it was.
Yeah,
I believe it was.
One.
Yeah. So we took a vote, and most of us wanted to go on, and so we went about another 75 miles or so, and we stopped again, and then everybody was pretty tired, and the consensus was that everybody wanted to stop, but Jerry said no, we're this close. We were only about 100 miles out then, and we were on the east of Riverside someplace, I believe. So he said, no, we're this close, let's go on. And by this time it was dark. So he said, okay, and everybody piled back in the cars, and we started out again. And I was having a hard time keeping awake. I don't know where everybody else was. And it must have been about 10, 11 o'clock at night. And we came down this long hill, and there was a sharp turn to the right, and a big orange orchard was down below. And we were following this duel. It was a man and his wife, I believe, and they were in this car ahead of us, towing another car. And I was right behind them. Somebody else was. I was driving. Somebody else was riding with me. And as we went down this hill, we saw the cars making the turn, and this car ahead of us, the taillights just went right straight on. They didn't make the turn, and all we saw was a big cloud of dust and smoke come up.
Into the orange grove?
Right into the orange grove.
Was it an incline something?
Yeah, it was a drop-off.
Oh,
it was down, yeah. They went down maybe 15, 20 feet or something off the road into this big orange orchard.
Mm.
Two more cars totaled. And the people were hurt, and they were bleeding, and it was a mess. And everybody, and that late at night, everybody was just exhausted anyway, and then to have this happen, these poor people were just out of it. So we piled them into our car, and we drove finally got into L.A., took them to the hospital.
That's the total cars in the orange
group. Yeah. And Jerry
lost four by this time.
There were four cars are lost by this time.
Lynch must have been excited.
he was jumping up and down. The air was blue. Yeah. So anyway, we finally got in, got them to the hospital, and got the cars down to Jerry's place of business, and then I was able to get a streetcar home, that then walked the streetcar and walking. I finally got home, I guess, about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
very glad to get home. But what a exhausting trip.
Incredible. And those caravans went out every day.
Oh, yeah.
Detroit, didn't they,
those days?
Similar experiences.
Yeah, they always ran these ads in the paper. Free transportation for drivers.
Right. Yeah.
So that was quite an experience. So anyway, I was glad, very glad to get back. Then I got a job with Safeway Stores, and I worked for Safeway for about a year, saving another bit of money, and to make another trip or another assault on Detroit.
No word from General Motors there, just
no, I know I didn't hear a word. Nothing from Howard O'Leary. So anyway, I made up some my samples and about a year later and got a ride back to Detroit with a family that they had advertised for people.
Oh, okay. Relief drivers and share expenses.
Share expenses, right.
Yeah.
A man and his wife and a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a 1930 Hudson. Mm-hmm. Pretty nice car. And this was in 34. So we started out, and it was in the fall of 34. And so we had they had all their luggage, and I had a couple of suitcases, and they had a trunk rack on the back of the car.
Yeah.
So
where was it again?
The trunk rack in the back of the car.
The back, right.
And so my suitcase was strapped on top of the mm-hmm. trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And then we even had some things on top of the car, too.
Yeah.
And I had a suitcase on top of the car and one on the back of the trunk strapped on there. Because it had some kind of a little rack on the top. So we started out, and we got... on this trip, we stopped at motels, a little auto courts.
Oh, yeah.
The way.
Right.
And so we got as far as Provo, Utah, and we were going over a very rough washboard, unpaved road. And somehow or other, my suitcase on the back of the car with my sample drawings and everything got lost. Bounced off the...
You didn't realize it was gone?
No, not until that night.
Oh, no.
Until we were
miles.
A couple hundred miles beyond.
Oh.
And looked back there, and my suitcase was gone. Strap broke.
Mm.
So...
It just wasn't feasible to go back as far as they were concerned.
No. They couldn't go back. I couldn't ask them to do that.
Yeah.
So, I had one suitcase with that. Luckily, I had some clothes in that. And so we finally got to Detroit, and so I rented a room in a rooming house, and decided to make some more samples. I don't think
sure.
I could do it. They were gone.
Yeah.
So I went down and got some drawing material and set up a little desk and made some more samples.
Where was the rooming house? Do you remember?
Well, it was the mother and brother and sisters of a fellow that I had met in California.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And he said, well, you're going back there. And he said, I think my mother has an extra room. And then he said, why don't you stay with them?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, fine. And so I stayed with them. And so he had, he was the one of the brothers was a young lawyer, budding lawyer, and he had a little office space downtown in the Penobscot building, I believe it was.
Right.
And he said, I had this little desk I was trying to work on at my home, and he said, there's an empty office next to me. He says, a lot of empty offices. And he says, there's a desk in there. He says, why don't you bring your stuff down there? And he said, you can work in there. So I said, great. So every morning I would go on the streetcar with him down to the Penobscot, and and I'd stay all day and work on these drawings. So
you're still living on your savings at this point.
Yeah, right. And so I finally finished these things, and I included one car, one design. It was a side view. a very streamlined car, as I remember, and then a front three-quarter perspective and a rear three-quarter perspective. And this is the first perspectives I'd ever done, ever attempted. And amazingly, they turned out pretty good, pretty accurate looking. And so, but this car was quite world's fairish. It had a single fin running down the center of the back. Of course, it had a fast back.
Oh, really?
And it had the Cadillac.
It had a dorsal fin?
A dorsal fin,
oh,
yeah.
That's great. Yeah.
And it had the Cadillac 16 pontoon type fenders. My version of them a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And the radiator was had a forward lean to it. Had a jutting forward, and instead of the grill, it had the openings were vertical and they were stamped out of the sheet metal. And then there were three chrome fins that ran around, something like the later Cord, only these fins were higher and
right.
ran around the nose of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Buick's the 36, 37 Cord had the fins, but they were down lower and
right.
with a ball nose at ball top.
Coffin nose.
Yeah,
yeah.
Coffin
yeah.
nose. Mm-hmm. Anyway, these were at the top running around. And so, anyway, I took these renderings to our drawings, or they were line drawings, they weren't colored, and to General Motors. And once again, I saw Howard Larry, and he was...
He
remembered me, and he said that he liked these new drawings even better than the ones before, and he said he thought they would have something for me. And anyway, he said that he would call me within a couple of weeks. And a couple of weeks went by, and he did call me, and he told me, he said he was sorry, but they just couldn't take anybody else on at that time. So somehow or other, I learned about Briggs Manufacturing that was over in Mack Avenue.
And they were doing most of the Chrysler work at that time, right? Or were they doing others?
They were doing Ford bodies and Chrysler.
Ford and Chrysler bodies.
And some Chrysler, yeah.
That's true, yeah.
I think it was mostly Ford.
You're right, yeah.
So I went over there and took the same samples over and met John Jarda. And they had a small design department there. John Jarda and Ralph Roberts shared an office.
Did they?
Yeah. They had it was a big office in the center of the building. On each side was a design room.
Mm-hmm.
John Jarda had his design section on one side, and Ralph Roberts had his design section on the other side. And they did mostly interiors, Ralph Roberts. And Jarda was exterior.
Spell Jarda for us, please, for the transcript.
Spell it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that I can spell it properly. I have
this is correct. Just add an extra A. Yeah. Just add an extra A, and you have it.
Oh, let's see how I got it spelled here. There's two A's in there, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. T J A A R D A.
Right.
John Jarda. And
was he chief designer at Briggs?
Yeah. Well.
Or was
he was well. Well, they were both chiefs.
Were they?
Yeah.
He and Ralph Roberts.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
They had, evidently, Ralph Roberts had come over to Briggs from his LeBaron operation in New York.
Right.
After Dietrich and Ralph Roberts split up, Ralph Roberts kept the LeBaron operation and Chrysler took over LeBaron some way or other,
right.
with Roberts heading up a small design section in Briggs.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, they did some custom work. I remember seeing complete custom bodies under the name of LeBaron,
mm-hmm.
and and then interiors. And the interiors were for Ford and Chrysler, as I recall. And Phil Wright worked for Ralph Roberts.
Oh, that's where he was.
Yes. And there was Phil Wright and about three or four other designers. Walt Lindgren, this fellow I mentioned previously, was one of the apprentice designers, and he had started to work there for Roberts just about two or three weeks before I came to Briggs.
What a coincidence!
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see you.
Well, I didn't know him at the time.
Oh, you met him.
I met him there.
That's right.
Yeah. So, anyway, I showed my samples to John Jarda, and he liked them. And he said, "Well, I think that we can use you here." So he said, "We'll start you out as a apprentice designer." And so I said, "Well, that's great." And he said, "We can pay $15 a week." Well, that's wonderful. So. I started there, working with, actually, well, there was only one other designer there, and his name was Clarence Karstad. I'd have to write it out.
Is it a C or K?
It's a very talented guy. Let's see. I believe it was spelled K-A-R-S-T-A-D-T.
Karstad.
Clarence Karstad.
Sounds good.
And he,
what was his?
His background was with Tiffany in New York.
Oh, really?
He was started out as a jewelry designer.
Oh.
And he did very small sketches. He'd start with a pencil and then do watercolor.